Tuesday, the 2nd of August, 2016. Excerpt from a letter to me from my father, written on the 14th of November, 1980. Quote, "And of course, our early relationship, in fact, the relationship that existed between all the units of our family group, was so screwed up, it buggered everything up. But somehow or other, we've survived. I don't now feel any guilt about those years, just a sadness, realizing now how much better they could have been, and how hollow and unimportant the goals I thought at that time were paramount. But once again, I suppose one should be grateful for what's been salvaged. I'm glad you realize that I did really have a deep, tender feeling for you. But what the hell is the use of having those feelings unless one can show and demonstrate they exist?" Unquote. Christchurch, July 2016. In the last few years, I've come to the realization that the central driving force behind my impulse to create work has been my childhood experience of the screwed-up family relationships described in the above excerpt, a domestic environment in which everything was buggered up. Unlike many screwed-up situations, this was a dysfunctional environment hidden beneath the veneer of a seemingly normal, outwardly ideal, nuclear family. I was an only child for the first 10 years of my life, and throughout this period, my public role was as an obedient, modest, and musically talented child. However, the underlying difficulties between my parents, concealed from everyone outside of our family, hovered like some ominous invisible vapour, enveloping me in an intensely disturbing atmosphere. I intuited that something was not right between them, a feeling generated by a profound tension that was never explicated. No overt interactions between them brought it into the light of day. It remained a dark, ever-present, dangerous force that might at any moment erupt, resulting in my total emotional destruction. Apparently, according to my mother, but never corroborated by my father, almost immediately after his return from World War II, an interaction occurred between him and my three-year-old self that caused me to be deeply afraid of him, some kind of reaction in him that caused him to physically strike me. I think it was the combination of this experience with the dysfunction between my parents that produced my psychological withdrawal. The moment when my father struck me must have initiated an intense response from my mother, thus cementing in me a cause and effect connection between my father's assault and the ongoing, unspoken, unresolved problem between my parents. At one level, I was oblivious to this fact, but at another, deeper level, I sensed I was not only at risk, but also the fulcrum upon which the entire difficulty balanced, the focal point, the cause. This was an almost corporeal assumption, ingrained into my subjective DNA. Of course, I was far too young for this to enter my head as fact. Instead, this conviction invaded my innate understanding as an unthinkable but constantly experienced reality. Consequently, I gradually began to create a place of safety within my own imagination, a dark, warm, internalized haven within which I could, for longer and longer periods, hold at bay my fearful uncertainty. Because my experience of the external pragmatic world was so fraught, I quickly grew to prefer the subjective sanctuary. This resulted in my view of the world becoming distorted, seen through the safety glass of a protective lens. My ability to respond easily to the prosaic cause and effect dynamics of the real world became limited. Everything was filtered through the permeable barrier of my sensibility into my private universe, a singular, totally personal context that only I understood, monitored only by me, and completely removed from and uncompromised by that other deeply disturbing realm. This gradually evolved into an intense emotional and intellectual iconoclasm. Hence the repeated traversing in so many of the works I produced over the last 40 years of the roles assumed within the family group. Many critics of the works have alluded to what has been labelled a narcissistic focusing on my personal feelings and responses. The autobiographical aspect is never far from the surface, and in some cases falls into an openly confessional mode. However, if the works are viewed as a lifetime's response to some deeply buried emotional dilemma, then their personal subject matter is, if not justified, then surely explained. I'm no longer apologetic for the content or mode of expression of my work. On the contrary, I believe the wellspring of their origin brings to the works a unique authenticity. I believe the feelings gathered in my hermetically sealed haven have been put under pressure, reduced through the application of a technique of expression into objects that carry a broader, more eclectic resonance than their original incarnation. Ultimately, these works exist precisely because the feelings that provoked them were in themselves inaccessible. Perhaps the working process functions as a releasing mechanism for those intuited but buried insights, making them extant and thus allowing me a more tangible understanding of their repercussions. These childhood experiences led to a mistrust of the underlying dynamics of my family. The Doreen, Ted, John context was somehow not as it seemed. I believe that my subsequent deep response to the physics of the inanimate natural world, temporal periodicities, inertia, momentum, etc., happened because it provided a trustworthy environment, one in which there was no human self-reflective involvement, no psychological agenda. Everything that occurred was explicable via the laws of physics. There were no hidden emotional traps. There were also no emotional demands made of me. I see this context as an extension of my safe haven. I could populate my sanctuary with objects that behaved predictably and which I imbued with a sublime numinosity. I truly feel that this is the complementary role played by these phenomena. They have never, however, been separate from the personal agenda that drives the work-making. I make the work for personal reasons, and this involves embracing a feeling world that includes the natural environment. So it seems that Studio 174 has gradually evolved into the material incarnation of that childhood sanctuary. It's a place where I habitually create an imaginative universe where my sensations are amplified with an interactive environment. Here I can be alone with my thoughts and feelings, safe in a resonant, dark, warm space where my preferences hold complete sway. A place where I am able to reassure myself of my own worth and render extant objects from that conviction, where no other individual can impose their point of view. I'm sure this is the reason why I've never been a successful collaborator or responder to outside commissions. No matter what the subject, in latter years this is extended far beyond the family, the requirement for authenticity remains paramount. There can be no faking. Direct, honest, real emotions and responses are imperative. Perhaps my emotionally confused childhood found a clarity in the pure sensation of dynamic aesthetic stimulation, at first in the area of conventional music, and then later inside the sonorous object. I know that I experience extreme visceral reactions to sensation, my feelings becoming seemingly supercharged. This might be a consequence of the intensity with which I first inhabited the world of my imagination. The more real I could make it, the more successfully it insulated me from that other untenable reality.
next station is coming.
قالوا نفقد الأوعى المدينة
spiders and then wee monkeys all the way around and then eagles and then take them around.
Around about the same time, I'm reading a critical series of articles on the filmmaker Ingmar Bergman. I come across this little paragraph. It's underneath a subheading called The Mark of Disaster. Quote, Bergman armed himself very early against all of these things, seeking refuge in his imagination. In the instinctive saving art of lying, a more or less deliberate blurring of the distinction between fantasy and reality, and in schizophrenia as a mode of survival. Unquote. 2nd of August 2016. Port Levy. I can't bring to mind the last time I experienced pure joy. Unmitigated radiant pleasure, with no shadow, unsullied and transcendental. I've been so preoccupied with my own pain without knowing it. My entire life has been driven by that initial alienation, a rejection forced on me, one that I can't remember, but which drove me so far into myself I've never fully emerged. All of my self-absorbed introspection has been the result of that single experience and its repercussions. It's taken the loss of someone I love to make me realise that I still cannot deal with rejection, particularly by one I understood to love me. How can I find the wherewithal to allow contact with him again, even if his attitude remains unchanged? At present, I find only fear and remembered injury in this prospect. I remain paralysed by it.
Oh, freedom.
Thank you. with a podcast? Definitely.
Oh, I want to play Master of Part Time for Dying to Go Home first.
Right.
I've never been there before.
It's just 10 minutes away from the house. Walk.
Yeah. It's pretty dark and it goes down quick, isn't it?
No, you wouldn't like to go now anyway. It gets dark and then.
August 2016. In case I forget. Quote from George Steiner, Grammars of Creation. Elsewhere, I've tried to draw attention to what remains as a terra incognita in linguistics, in poetics, in epistemology, Husserl being the exception. It is that of inward speech, of the discourse we conduct incessantly with ourselves. This unvoiced soliloquy, in fact, contains the bulk of speech acts. It far exceeds in volume language used for outward communication. Unquote. The image on the cover of this program is of the hard copy collection of work notes made since 2002, organised in yearly folders. The notes document interior monologues, or more accurately, dialogues with myself. They range from descriptions of technical difficulties and solutions, to aesthetic dilemmas, to personal blocks and breakthroughs, to other more generalised observations. Their main purpose has been to serve as useful retrospective references when I find myself unable to proceed with current work. As I solved the problem then, so shall I again. Task. Beginning with the latest entry, I record my reading of the work notes, moving backwards in time, producing hours of recorded monologue. I then gradually layer the recordings in an exponential curve of increased textual density. This results in the eventual nullification of the semantic function of the recorded sentences as the vowels, consonants, etc. separate into polarized spectral layers that ultimately drown the contributing thoughts and concepts in an ocean of sonority. Which prompts the question, what sound would be produced if every thought silently uttered to themselves by every human being, alive or dead, were to be spoken aloud, recorded and played back as a simultaneous event, a grand collective tutti?
Thank you.
Monday, the 29th of September 2016. All sorts of dilemmas regarding the stations piece. In particular, how many and what kind of repertoire should be included in the train travel episodes. Also, how to make the point of a mass or whether to. Plus the problem of identifying individuals on the train, how to do this. Need to work much more with the materials and let the fallout from this decide things. Wednesday, the 2nd of November 2016. Making progress with the stations piece. Taking a while, but my intention of letting the structural problems fall out from the working process is working. Every now and then, I get a little nervous about using cultural material willy-nilly. The irony of using the Vaughan Williams Fantasia when he uses a previous work as a basis. His excuse would be that he's created an entirely other work, a contemporary experience, an additional view from the Tallis theme, rather than simply a pastiche. So I guess I have to do the same with my appropriated materials. They need to combine and transform in ways that facilitate fresh insights, juxtapositions that resonate anew. If this doesn't happen, then those materials become bland quotations, or even worse, stolen treasures. Colleen being in Scotland at the moment lends me a big period of time to concentrate on this work. It's difficult, but also invigorating. On the 19th of October 2016, 10 stations on the Strathclyde Underground. Notes from Glasgow, Christmas 2015. On the underground again, a man-made horizontal hole in the ground. We sit engrossed in cell phone doodling, reading, feigning sleep, covertly scanning the faces of nearby occupants, or intently contemplating a spot on the floor just in front of our feet. Nearly everyone displays the required indirect, distracted, introspective but far away gaze. I've often observed this, but today, for some reason, the passengers resonate for me as individuals, their intimate, usually concealed fears and hopes becoming overt and acutely available to me, and I feel a deep empathy for them all, or should I say, for us all. The noise of the train, and while in motion, is often unbearable in its intensity, the highly congested aural spectrum encouraging phantom sound gestures to emerge, rotate, explode and dissolve within my speculative aural imagination. A woman seated opposite me and listening to headphones shifts her head slightly to one side and leans forward. It seems she is welcoming the sounds, somehow anticipating her responses, desiring the feelings she knows she's about to experience. Her private musical responses, ironically auditioned within the din of the clattering carriage, promise consolation within the meaning they carry. They can provide the answer to a dilemma that has no tangible resolution in our everyday prosaic lives, but which hovers over our every waking moment. We're on the train from birth to death, carried along a predetermined pathway, sealed within the vacuum pack of our particular life experience, waiting, inert and unresisting, for the motion to slow and stop, and for death to enter, along with the outside acoustic ambience leaking in through the open doors of the carriage. Only as we near our destination, amid a growing awareness of the transience of our individual lives, do we recognise the incredible fact of our predicament. The collision of our egos with the apparition of death is apparently an inevitable experience for us all. Latent at the moment of birth, at first as a barely perceptible corona, eventually, if we live long enough, it's revealed as a fully extant, all-encompassing, inescapable eclipse. 10 stations, devotional sources. O Freedom, traditional gospel song. Mass for Four Voices, William Byrd. New Zealand Māori Karanga. Traditional Persian flute melody. Enunciation of the Quran. The Lamentations of Jeremiah the Prophet, Thomas Tallis. Gregorian chant. Australian Aboriginal corroboree. Christmas Carol, brass band. Fantasia on a theme by Thomas Tallis by Vaughan Williams. him to be a pilgrim, John Bunyan. Muslim call to prayer, Buddhist Om. Friday the 18th of November 2016. First listener to 10 stations tonight and full of trepidation. Listened yesterday and it seemed like a load of junk. Hate it when that happens. I'll try now to see if I can find another element that might propel the thing towards a better outcome, or is it just me? The concept is clear and the concept requires a metaphorical response, or rather for the listener to perceive the juxtapositions of imagery as a metaphor. If they merely hear it as a series of banal realities, all is lost. So how do I ensure that this does not happen? I can't. And we're back to the old haiku thing. Tuesday, the 29th of November 2016. Interesting documentary last night on Rembrandt and his influences, in particular Caravaggio and Rubens. So much of his technique seemed to somehow resonate with me and how I'm treating texture at present, especially in 10 stations. I thought about my prolonged fascination with Caravaggio, Rembrandt and Turner, and the fact that the first two are portraitists and Turner transcends nature in his landscapes. They're more about the spirit than any sort of pantheism. But the sudden light dark of Caravaggio, the raised impasto of Rembrandt, and the swirling, almost completely abstract textures of Turner all make sense, and I think are present in my work. Light and dark, high and low frequencies. Impasto, frontal short durational gestures placed on top of lower, longer frequency washes and textural turmoil created by combinations of various sound gestures. I think I've gradually learned a lot from these painters, and more the process of composing feels akin to a visual one, combining files, then altering and transforming each so that a more effective overall result is finally attained. I'm still working on 10 stations. Each time I think I have completed, a new raft of ideas and processes arises. 4th of December 2016. Thinking about my last conversation with Michael Brown from the Turnbull Library, and what needs to be saved of the work, and I realise I have simple priorities. Number one, the works themselves need to be available for the instrument. This means bounced stereo files. These can then be put into any playback platform, connected to any hardware, and auditioned within a configuration that is the equivalent of the Acousmonium in Studio 174. Two, the work should also exist as stereo bounces, preferably as CDs within the programme booklet. The combination of these two formats is all that is necessary. The archiving of the so-called master sessions is probably unnecessary and not of much use. My compositional procedures are extant in the final work and are of little interest in themselves. Sunday, the 11th of December 2016. Aftermath of John Coulter's visit. Wonderful. Relating to the Corrientes work. It was clear that the image stream detracted markedly from the impact of the sound world, in particular the video section of the disrupted portrait installation. John said that the data stream was so intense, so much being demanded of the attention of the viewer, that the parallel sound world was unheard. We experienced the work twice, once with image and then acousmatically. It was clear that the second listening was so much more sonically palpable. However, John said that the acousmatic experience made sense because it was heard in the light of the first experience with images. The content of the images was important in specifying the sounds, but they were best as remembered images rather than simultaneously experienced ones. We discussed various options to put the images before the listener before they listened acousmatically, multiple video screens, etc., etc. I intend following up the suggestion, but already feel myself returning to the original version. I think the images are an important element in the work, this being the reason they were generated after the sound work had been completed. John says that this fact, complete sound world, then images afterwards, can't work. That the images and sounds must be either isomorphically or concomitantly related. I think he's correct in some contexts. However, the present form of the work, even although it does force the sound world into the background, is effective as an entire experience. Certainly the sound world alone, without the context of the image stream, is not specific enough to generate the necessary conclusions in the listener. At the moment, I therefore feel that I must accept the sound-image relationship as it is. Note, the constriction of the listener's imagination enforced by the concurrent image can be seen, as John suggested, as a limitation. For example, the opening slow pan over the still image of the two women while the lyrics are being spoken. In the acousmatic experience, John felt he could allow his imagination to reflect solely upon the spoken lyrics. However, it's not my intention to allow this. The purpose of the image is to underwrite the lyrics as a metaphor. They are not to be taken literally, but rather to combine with the image of the women to form a more complex response. This is important in the remainder of the work, as without the images, the tango song becomes literal, and the entire work orients itself around it, whereas my intention is to use the song as a metaphor for the tragedy of the disappearances. And on we go.